How has the American dream failed the West?
I think the American dream in many ways is part and parcel of our notion of the American West. And the trouble is that we thought this was the place it would come to fruition. We thought this idea of manifest destiny, that we would spread this patchwork blanket of small farms across the entire nation. And it didn't work. It never worked. It still hasn't worked. And in a lot of ways, especially the High Plains West, the Mountain West, we're still paying that price economically, ecologically, physically in many ways, for this sort of wrongheaded notion of this manifest destiny patchwork quilt of farms across the country. And so we need to find a better way to be in this place. And I think there are people doing that, and I am so pleased about that, but we need to keep working.
Hello, and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the Western United States. Our funding comes from Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio. I'm Sarah Aronson, talking with Joe Wilkins about his debut novel, Fall Back Down When I Die. Don't go away. The book takes place in the Bull Mountains of Montana and begins with a down-on-his-luck young ranch hand named Wendell, who's taken in a traumatized boy. During the time of the first legal wolf hunt in Montana after more than 30 years, Rowdy Burns is the boy. Can you begin by describing the relationship between Wendell and Rowdy?
Yeah, absolutely. Wendell, to me, is a young man who's got promise, but who has been for often, though he also makes his own mistakes, but often forces beyond his control have conspired against him. And this, of course, happens to so many young people in rural poverty, that things just line up one after the other, and despite their best intentions, despite their hard work, it just gets in the way and it drags them down. And it seems, I think, in the beginning that when he suddenly has to take care of this young, traumatized, shirt-tail relation of his, Rowdy Burns, that this might be one more of those things, that it might be one more of those things that pulls him down, that gets in his way. But it doesn't turn out that way. Rowdy, in some ways, is what his presence, his person, allows Wendell to be who he can be in many ways. And so I love that they do that for one another. Wendell cares for Rowdy, and Rowdy, by his presence, by being there to be cared for, allows Wendell to become the person he can be.
And there's this moment of deep empathy because of Rowdy's history, where Wendell essentially rises to the occasion and says, I won't let this boy be raised fatherless. And one of the quotes from your book is, how many nights had Wendell wished his own father would crawl out of the mountains?
Yeah.
Where does a line like that come from for you?
A lot of places. And I think, you know, fatherlessness is rampant in this book. There's a lot of missing fathers. And I think that is also true of many communities of poverty, true of many rural communities too. And that's an ache that people feel, a whole community feels. And I think Wendell feels it especially because he is then sort of marooned. You know, he's this young man in this stereotypically masculine place without the model of a father, without someone to guide him and lead him. And he wants that. He wants that very badly. And of course it hooks in with my own biography, and that I lost my father when I was young. And that ache is always with me. That wish to see him just suddenly arises. And, you know, I know it does for Wendell, as well as many of the other characters in the book.
That's right. Your memoir is The Mountain and the Fathers, Growing Up on the Big Dry. I wanted to know then, why write this book through fiction? And what were you able to reckon with in a different way through the fiction form?
Great question. I think in a lot of ways, you know, I wrote my story in The Mountain and the Fathers, and I'm very proud of the book. But I also sort of, after completing it, immediately realized that, of course, there's, you know, there's lapses, there's failings in it, because it's my vision of this place. It's my own look at my own story. And that's valuable and a wonderful thing that I was able to write it, that people have responded to it well. But there's also a lot of other ways of looking at that place. And there's a lot of other experiences that matter in that place. And so the novel is a chance for me to go back there, to be there again, and to try to see it with different eyes, to try to hold these other visions as close to me as I can without judgment, with a kind of, okay, I'm just going to be here with this for a while. Just listen, just watch, just see. And so in a lot of ways, I'm attempting to do that with the novel.
I can't wait to talk about the other voices you bring in. But first, Will you read a scene with Rowdy and Wendell?
Yeah, absolutely. So this is, Wendell has taken Rowdy to work with him. He doesn't know what else to do. He doesn't have a babysitter for the day. And so they're in the grain truck driving. Late in the evening, the sun bleeding through the pines, the broken land about going shadowed and blue. Wendell turned to find the boy sitting ramrod straight on the bench seat, like he'd been most of the day, scrawny shoulders cockeyed, eyes wide as skipping rocks. Wendell figured Glenn would most likely work them until midnight to try to catch up, and remembering the tall bedtime tales his old man used to spin for him, he thought he might tell a story to help the boy relax, maybe even curl up and close his eyes. What say I tell a story? What would you say to that? The boy turned and blinked, waited. All right then, let me get a dip here first. Wendell reached for the can of Copenhagen he'd left on the dash, thumped it once, and set it on his thigh. Left hand on the wheel, he carefully worked the lid off with his right and set it too on his thigh and pinched up a chew. Just as he got the tobacco situated in his lip, the boy reached over for the tin and the lid and clicked the two together and handed the can back to Wendell. Wendell smiled, winked at the boy. I don't care what anyone says, Rowdy Burns. You're a gentleman.
Who or what do you think Rowdy represents?
That's a great question. Rowdy, to me, in some ways, he's the foil. He's what starts the action, right? His presence, him suddenly coming into Wendell's life allows all these things to happen. And so there's a way in which, you know, he seems maybe kind of like a prop in the beginning. But as I got to know him more too, Rowdy to me is another young man without a father in the beginning. And he's someone too who can't speak. He can't speak his own truth. And I think a lot of this book is about people trying to speak what they have on their minds and also being willing to listen. And, you know, in the passage I just read, we see Rowdy listening and Wendell having a chance to speak. And he doesn't realize he's ached for that, to be able to tell these stories he has. And Rowdy is someone who will listen. And eventually, you know, as their relationship grows, Wendell becomes someone who will listen both to the boy's actual voice, but also to his presence, his physicality, who he is and what he needs.
It sort of struck me that Rowdy is like the scar, you know, is sort of like what's left after we've done what we've done to the West.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
So there are female characters too. I don't want to forget about them. you know, there's a single mother, Jillian, who's an apparent alcoholic. Her husband was killed and she's raising her teen daughter, Maddie. Yeah. And I just wanted to know, what's your relationship with parenting? Because so much of the book is about single parents, actually, and broken families, which you've mentioned. But what about you?
Yeah. I think in some ways, I always say Gillian.
Gillian.
But either one is fine. But, you know, I think in some ways, her being this mother trying as hard as she can, as well as being a teacher, someone who cares for young people beyond her own, feels very close to me, feels very close to my mom, who was a public school teacher here in Montana for many, many years. And I think the idea of parenting, you know, and you talked about Rowdy as the scar that's left after what we've done to the West. And I think in a lot of ways, you know, that brunt, the ecological disaster, the physical disaster, the economic disaster falls directly on families. And it means that it is hard to raise children. And so watching this, knowing it from my own life, knowing it now as a parent myself, not living in Montana, it's already hard. It doesn't need to be harder. And so much of the book is about that, is about the relationships between mothers and daughters and fathers and sons and how we might parent even when things are even when we're struggling and even when forces are bearing down upon us.
Mm. And there's also a cast of disaffected fringe folk. Mm. What were you trying to capture with these characters?
You know, there's this wonderful Eudora Welty short story called Where's the Voice Coming From? And the story's written in a, in the voice of the murderer of Medgar Evers. And Eudora Welty, a white Mississippian, heard that Medgar Evers, a black Mississippian and civil rights leader, had been murdered, and she was living in New York City at the time. And her first thought was, I know who did it, as if not the actual person, but the kind of person, because they were her people. And watching, especially as I moved away from the West, looking back at our disagreements, at our struggles, though I don't find myself siding politically or morally with many of the arguments that are coming from the right in the West, I also think, but I understand, I know them. They're my people. And this was especially poignant for me watching the Bundys when they took over the Malheur Wildlife Refuge, which I think I disagree with them in almost every respect. But every time I saw Ammon Bundy on videos or heard his voice, I thought, I know him. Mm-hmm. We could sit down and have a beer. And I also found myself really reacting strongly against the way they were portrayed in especially wider liberal media, as if they were cartoons, caricatures. And I thought, well, they're many things, but they're not that. You know, they're real human beings. And we need to deal with them as such. And so the folks, sort of this disaffected fringe group, I try to deal with them as human beings as much as I can in the book, to try to bring them, to not treat them as caricatures, but people with their own stories and their own struggles.
And one of the ways you do that is by writing in the voice of Verl, which is sort of a collection of letters or a diary entry. And I wanted to know what your relationship was to Verl.
Yeah.
If you could describe him and also then read a bit from his voice.
Verl's the character who came to me first. This began as a short story, and his voice was that voice, as Eudora Welty says, I know who did it. Verl's voice came to me. I felt like I knew this person, and I knew where he was speaking from. And so I wanted to give him a chance to talk. I wanted to listen to him, mm-hmm. Even though it's not very comfortable sometimes. And so I did that, wrote that story, and Verl's done something he can't take back. He's both killed a wolf in the 90s when they're still on the endangered species list, and then he's also committed other violent crimes, and he's on the run in the Bull Mountains, and he's writing. And in the beginning, you know, he's trying to speak. He wants to say something, and he does these violent things, which are in some ways, this, you know, his speech, but it's the wrong speech. And so he's trying to, I think, rectify that in some ways. And so he's writing in this notebook he has. In the beginning, he's writing to the feds who are after him, in this rage, just reacting so strongly. But then he sort of turns that and begins to write towards his son. And that for me was where I really found Verl, when he starts to write to his son and try to reckon with what he's done and what it might mean for this boy he's left behind. Verl, 21. Not even that much below freezing, and still so cold. God damn, how I would like a fire. I cannot have a fire. They are after me. Here's what I do. I dig down as deep as I can, which is not too deep, for soon there are roots and rocks, but no matter, I burrow in there like an old bear and heap sand and leaves and needles over me. It helps, some. The rocks are hard beneath me and give me back some portion of my heat. I only wish against the wind. The trees in this dry country are scrawny as mutt dogs, and the night wind scrapes along the top of me like a dull knife down my bones. I'm sorry to go on like this. I should not complain. It is my own goddamn doing. I should have brung more clothes, more food. Should not have shot that deer. Should not have done so many things. I took this wolf tooth like it mattered. Later, I think now we would get along, the wolf and me. It would be nice to hear her howl at a fat moon when I too am holed up beneath the moon, my belly howling. Later, her tooth at my throat, the lengths of her claws.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to a conversation with Joe Wilkins about his debut novel, Fall Back Down When I Die. This is The Right Question. I'm Sarah Aronson. Our full conversation can be found online at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook. Joe, I once took a craft workshop with you about the layers of landscape.
Oh, yeah. Right.
What are the layers that you're working with in the book?
Yeah, yeah. I hope I'm working with all of them. I'm working with the physical landscape, the fact of it itself. I think that more than we know, the physical facts of the land around us matter to us deeply and shape our days. There's a wonderful line from Annie Dillard's memoir, Childhood, where she talks about when, I'm going to get the quote wrong, but she said, when all else has gone from my brain, there will be the fact of the land itself, mm-hmm. right? And so I think that I'm trying to get that, the fact of the land itself in here. But I'm also trying to layer on the historical necessities of this landscape, what's been done here and how that then sort of tunnels down through the lives of these characters. And I'm trying to get the cultural landscape here and the ways that it is nuanced and textured and not a monoculture of in this rural part of Montana, but a really nuanced and interesting cultural landscape. And I'm trying to find ways that all these match and become metaphorical, begin to say things both about the characters, about the landscape, and beyond that, about, say, the American dream or the failure of our settlement of the West.
I can't wait to talk about mythology a bit later. Mm-hmm. But in a conversation with me, you've also referenced Montana as your primal landscape mm-hmm. and not mm-hmm. your chosen one.
Yeah.
How have you sorted out the difference between these two things?
Yeah, they get confused. It is absolutely the primal landscape. It's the landscape I see when I dream. It's the landscape I see first when I close my eyes. It will be with me forever. But I've lived a lot of places, and I've enjoyed a lot of places and admired a lot of places. I live now in Western Oregon. In some ways, I went from the big dry to the big wet, this land of ferns and slugs and great tall western red cedar trees. And I deeply love it. And I think in a lot of ways, it's becoming a home landscape as well, mostly because of my children's experience of it. You know, it is their primal landscape. And so I'm beginning to know it with them. And so in a lot of ways, I feel like it's not quite as clear cut as I once thought it was, that Montana is just the primal landscape and not the chosen landscape. I think in some ways, the valley in Oregon we live in and eastern Montana will always be in this sort of relationship for me.
There's a bit of a meditation in the book coming from Verl, where you write in his voice, "Does some bear up in the Rockies remember he walked these hills and plains and pine for them? Mm-hmm. I say yes. Does the country grieve my old granddaddy? The gone grizzly bears, does it sorrow the both of them?"
Yeah.
And I'm trying to wrap my head around the relationship between place and its inhabitants. And what's your sense of that?
Yeah, yeah. I think in many ways our contemporary culture has tried to obliterate place. We ride on airplanes that take us from place to place in a matter of hours. We journey into the no place of the internet, of television. We can eat at the same restaurants and stay at the same hotels and buy the same kinds of houses from coast to coast. And so our culture doesn't have a lot of room for place. And I think that's been at a great cost, a cost ecologically, but also a cost to our own health, our own sense of ourselves and our own stories. And for all of the ways I disagree with Verl, I think Verl has this sense. He hasn't forgotten this, the ways that place matters deeply to him and help him understand who he is. Of course, he's also got blind spots. He, you know, his vision of this place goes back to his grandfathers, and he's forgetting, of course, the genocide they perpetrated to take that from the original inhabitants. And so he has his blind spots, but he also has something that's real, this sense that this place matters and has infused him with a kind of a way of being, and that he has also been in relationship with a place, that he's changed it. And he knows that, and that's something I think we need to remember.
Native Alaskan poet and memoirist Ernestine Hayes writes, "The very land sees you. The land loves you. She misses her children." Do you think the Bull Mountains miss you, Joe?
I hope so. I miss them. I hope they do. I hope that place misses me, misses the child I was, running through the cottonwoods, dreaming up big stories, pretending to be a mountain man or a trapper or a crow scout or whatever it was I was pretending at the time. I do think the land is so much wiser than we give it credit for. The ways that it has found a way to be what it is in this vast, intricate ecological relationship among all its constituent parts. And I think we can be part of that. Often we're not, but we can be. And when we are, I think then we become part of the memory of the land.
There's a passage that when I got to it, I realized, oh, this is Joe Wilkins speaking the truth. And I was hoping that you would just read it.
Yeah. So I'm going to read this section from Gillian's point of view. She has just heard on public radio that there is a hostage situation in her old hometown in Delphia, Montana, and she believes her daughter's somehow involved. And so she's gotten her husband's old guns out of the upstairs attic and put them in her car, and she's headed out into the mountains. And as she's doing so, she's, of course, meditating on her experience in that part of the country and thinking about why this is happening to her and how she has become involved. Was this where it had begun? In bygone notions and blind myths, the idiocy of watering the bar ditch, the vanity of irrigating this dry land at all, the land where the failures of the nation, the failures of myth, met the failures of men, where history went to die, where rivers brimful in April slicked to gravel by August, where the grass was tough and thick before the plow, and ever after dust lifted from the sour alkali hardpan left in the plow's wake. A land of ravaging pine beetles, of ever longer summers and shorter, drier winters, the land itself animated sorrow and anger, birthed and cradled and raised up failure and fear, a raw and righteous violence.
What do you think is this raw and righteous violence?
I think that violence comes when we don't listen to the lessons of the landscape, when we try to hang on because it's the way we've always done things, or the way that some ancestor did things, and we don't find a way to evolve, and we don't find a way to be in a dynamic relationship with the landscape. And we're hanging on so hard, and we're digging in so hard that it becomes a kind of violence. Often it's a violence against the self, against the land. But then it can also become a violence against other human beings, and that's, of course, what Gillian's dealing with here.
Joe, you don't strike me as a violent guy, but there's a part of me that's wondering, like, what's your relationship to guns, even, you know?
Yeah, no, I don't think I'm a violent guy either. but I do think I was raised in a place where violence was something we were part of every single day. And sometimes that violence was a necessary violence, right? The violence of killing and butchering yearling sheep to put in the freezer for the year. The violence of hunting antelope and deer, which we started in on when the yearling ran out. That kind of violence is a violence, and I think we have to treat it as such. We can't get used to that, but we also need to know that it is necessary, and that all of us, whether we're the ones doing the butchering or not, are participating by our very lives. Some violence will be done, and we can't get away from that fact. And so that's something I often think about, and because the life I live now, I'm somewhat isolated from that. I want to remember that. I want to try to keep that in my life as much as I can.
This interview is very heavy on pulling in other people's voices, but it's because your work was ringing through me.
Oh, good.
In serendipitous ways, maybe, or synchronistic ways.
Yeah.
So I just want to read you this John Haynes quote.
Yeah.
From his book of essays, Living Off the Country. He writes, "Finally, the dream of frontier America must face itself. There is nowhere else to go. And it may be that deep down we're afraid that it is already a failure so enormous we have no words for it."
Yeah, wow.
He's writing about Alaska.
Yeah.
And I was thinking, you have tried to wrap some beautiful words around, I think, that exact place of tension. Why are you so compelled by it?
I was born to it, for one, right? It's the story I was handed. I think, too, that even though, you know, this is a Western book, it's a Montana book, but it's also really, as we started this conversation, it's the crux of the nation.
Yes.
It is sort of the most American part of us was the West, the frontier. And to understand ourselves as Americans, to understand our moment and our own violence as a culture in the world, we need to understand this. We need to try to reckon with our history here in the West.
I'm picturing you in the greens of Oregon with all kinds of summer bounty and just wondering, what is your vision then for the New West?
Yeah. And of course, it's a different vision because it's such a different landscape there. We need to be more local, more regional. And I think my vision for the West is one that involves a lot of voices. And it involves, surely, ranchers and farmers who've been on their land for 3 and 4 generations, but it also needs to involve people who are trying new ways of ranching and farming. It needs to involve rural intellectuals and artists. It needs to involve people who are thinking, who are loving this landscape because they love to go climb rocks on it, or whatever their passion is for this landscape. But it has to involve a lot of creative, diverse ways of thinking about very particular landscapes, because we're not going to be able to transport this from here to there to here. Perhaps some of the ideas or some of the ways, the processes, but the actualities are particular to the land itself. And so we need to make them match. Where I am in Oregon in the Willamette Valley, we're just lousy with wonderful agriculture because it's a floodplain. It's a beautiful, bountiful land, and there's all these biodynamic wineries and CSAs, whole diet CSAs, where you get, 80-90% of your food from a particular farm. And these are ways people are trying to be in relationship with that land in a healthy way. And what's interesting, of course, in that landscape is that it's working. The salmon runs on the Yamhill River, where I live, are far stronger now than they were 30 years ago when it was a monoculture of turkey farms, which were so decimating the river that the salmon couldn't survive. And they're coming back. Of course, we've still got our own struggles and issues, but there are ways we can be on this landscape in a right relationship.
Switching gears to my last question. Mm-hmm. You originally went to college and graduated as a computer engineer. Mm-hmm. You taught math, and you have thrown yourself headlong into your prolific writing career as a poet, memoirist, and now novelist.
Yeah.
What is your advice for shy writers who may be off track doing something else? How would you call them in?
Yeah. I tell my students all the time that you have all sorts of lives, right? You have a life as a college student, you have a life as a friend, a life as a daughter, and your writing life is one of those lives. And if it begins to matter to you, if it begins to sort of resonate to you and feel like you are healthiest and wholest and fullest when you are writing, when you are finding a way to make that a pretty big part of your life, then you need to do that, right? Like anything that gives us joy, if it's yoga or quilting or whatever it happens to be, we find ways to make it a part of our life. We find ways to build it into our practice as a human being. And if that's the case, if that's something that matters to you, then you need to attend to it.
In addition to fiction, Joe Wilkins is the author of 3 poetry collections and a memoir. He's from the Big Dry of eastern Montana, but now resides with his family in the Big Wet of Oregon, where he directs the creative writing program at Linfield College. Look for more information about him and his work at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and visit our Facebook page. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting us since 2008, and thanks to you for listening. I'm Sarah Aronson, and this has been The Right Question.
The Right Question is produced by Sarah Aronson, Beth Ann Austin, studio engineer and production assistant. The music in this program was written and performed by John Floridis.